fiancé?
That's right. And who is this person, Conrad?
This person is sitting right here, and she can speak for herself. My name is Rebel Callahan.
Rebel? One of those dreadful unreconstructed Confederates, I suppose?
I wasn't born until after the War of Northern Aggression, but I carry the name proudly. Proudly enough to get down off this horse and show
Ladies,
you a little...
Ladies, please.
Even here in a mining boomtown in the middle of the Mimbres Mountains in New Mexico Territory, Pamela Tarleton managed to dress in an elegant, stylish manner. Her dark green gown was cut low enough in front to reveal the top of the valley between her rather large breasts, and it hugged her slender waist tightly before flaring out over her hips and thighs. Her brown hair fell below her shoulders in the sort of thick curls that made a man want to plunge his hand into it and run his fingers through the silken tresses. The hair framed a lovely face, highlighted by a pair of compelling green eyes. Now that he looked back and forth between them, Conrad wasn't sure if Rebel was prettier or not. It would have been a damned close contest.
Conrad, dear, you should have told me that you were coming. The prospect of seeing you again would have brightened considerably the dreary days I've been forced to spend here.
I didn't know exactly when I'd arrive. Besides, I wasn't sure you'd be here either.
Where else would I be? My father insists on dragging me along with him, although why he thinks I need to come on these business trips, I'll never know.
I'm sure he just wants to show off his beautiful daughter.
I reckon you forgot to tell me that you're engaged to be married, Conrad, dear.
Good Lord, could she have said anything worse?
What does this woman mean by that?
She doesn't mean anything. She's merely speaking facetiously. Making a joke, if you will.
He managed to put a weak smile on his face, but he didn't know if it would fool anyone. Pamela certainly wasn't fooled.
Are the two of you traveling together?
We rode up together from Lordsburg.
That's right, lady. We spent a lot of days and nights together on the trail, didn't we, Conrad?
We weren't alone.
Suddenly, anger at being trapped between them like this flared up inside him.
Perhaps we should start over with some proper introductions.
I don't need to be introduced
Miss Callahan, this is Miss Tarleton. Miss Tarleton, this is Miss Callahan. Miss Tarleton is one of the Philadelphia Tarletons, and the daughter of Mr. Clark Tarleton, the noted financier and industrialist. Miss Callahan is from Texas and is the former owner of a cattle ranch there. She had business dealings with an acquaintance of mine, Mr. Frank Morgan, and accompanied Mr. Morgan and myself here to New Mexico Territory. Everything was completely proper and above board, Pamela, I assure you.
She came along with you and this fellow Morgan unchaperoned?
Well, yes. You have to understand, darling, the West is a somewhat less formal place than what you're used to.
I should say so. Where I come from, proper young women do not travel unattended with gentlemen who are not related to them.
And maybe you better get it through your head that you ain't back where you came from anymore.
Trust me, Miss Callahan, I am well aware of that.
Rebel sat on her horse and glared. Pamela turned her head away and ignored the other girl. But at least they didn't look like they were ready to start swinging punches at each other, and Conrad was grateful for that. Not that Pamela would ever have thrown a punch, he amended mentally. She was much too genteel for that. Rebel, on the other hand...
Is your father here?
Yes. He's inside this store, talking to the merchant.
Conrad glanced up at the sign over the door. It read, Kandinsky's General Mercantile.
He's making some sort of arrangement with the man to supply provisions for the workers at the mine.
I see.
Come inside with me, dear. I'm sure Father will be glad to see you. He's always been fond of you.
Conrad hesitated and glanced at Rebel.
Go ahead. Don't mind me. I'll just take your horse and go down to the livery stable with him.
Thank you, Rebel. That's very kind of you.
They nada.
Leading the black horse, Rebel rode on down the street toward a livery barn with its big double doors open so that light spilled out into the street. Conrad knew he had offended her, and he was sorry about that. He probably should have told her that he was engaged to be married. But he truly hadn't known that Pamela would be here in Ophir. He had known that she might be. In fact, probably would be. But it had been easier not to say anything about that to Rebel. And before that, not to say anything to Frank.
Come, dear.
Of course, dear.
Father, look who's here.
Browning! Good to see you again, young man. How are you?
Clark Tarleton was around 50, a tall, broad-shouldered, beefy man who, despite his expensive clothes and well-barbered appearance, still bore traces of the steel mill laborer he had been in his youth. Before he had raised himself by hard work and sheer willpower from that position to become one of the leading industrialists in the East. He had added mining to his business interests several years earlier and now owned several mines in this southwestern corner of New Mexico territory. Conrad supposed that technically Tarleton was one of Browning Mines and Manufacturing's rivals, but that wouldn't be the case for much longer. Once he and Pamela were wed, like the merger of two royal families in Europe by marriage, everything would be all in the family.
I'm just fine, sir. It's good to see you two. How are things in Philadelphia?
I wouldn't know. I'm never there long enough to find out. Always traveling, you know. My interests are so widespread, they keep me busy all the time.
I can certainly imagine.
Luckily, I have Pamela to keep me company. But not for much longer if you succeed in stealing her away from me.
I suppose she'll be traveling with me then.
For a while, maybe. But then you'll have her at home, no doubt, giving birth to all the Browning heirs.
Oh, Father, how you do go on.
Conrad just smiled, too uncomfortable with the subject to get into any discussion of heirs and how they came about.
Anyway, I'm not sure whether Conrad still intends to marry me or not. He's taken up with a frontier woman, a wild creature who rides astride and carries a rifle.
What's that?
It's nothing, I assure you, sir. While I was traveling up here to Ophir with an associate, we escorted a lady who was also heading in this direction.
That was a considerable distortion of the facts, but Conrad didn't care.
The situation was totally innocent.
His brain picked that precise moment to remind him of the way Rebel had kissed him and the wanton images that had filled his head when she talked about taking off all of her clothes and jumping into that pond.
Well, I suppose we can't blame you for trying to be a gentleman. Isn't that right, darling?
I suppose.
How's your mining operation going, sir?
Quite well. Lucky for us, there's plenty of gold and silver to go around, or you and I might be at each other's throats. Figuratively speaking, of course.
Of course.
Conrad was glad that wasn't the case. Having Clark Tarleton as a friendly rival and potential partner was one thing. Having a man like him as an enemy was something totally different.
What about that railroad of yours? Is everything on schedule there? The sooner we have reliable rail service in and out of this place, the sooner we'll all be that much richer, eh?
It's coming along just fine. The line should be completed soon.
Really? I've heard rumors that there have been problems with the construction. Indian trouble, among other things.
Well, it's true that there seems to be a band of renegade Apaches loose in the mountains. And while their presence has made the workers a bit nervous, construction is continuing on a steady pace.
What about the accidents I've heard talked about?
Any project as large as the building of a railroad will have problems.
I've been told that it's deliberate sabotage.
The situation is being taken care of even as we speak.
Conrad was anxious for Tarleton not to see him as weak.
That business associate I spoke of is out at the construction camp right now, getting to the bottom of the problems and putting an end to them.
Who might that be?
Conrad had hoped to avoid bringing Frank's name into the discussion, but he didn't have much choice.
Frank Morgan.
The infamous gunman? I saw a traveling stage play about him once. Terribly violent. They say he's killed hundreds of men. Good Lord, son, how do you know a man like Frank Morgan?
Conrad thought quickly, trying to come up with an answer that would avoid the full truth.
We met several years ago. He was an old friend of my late mother's.
Has he?
He didn't, though. Not really. And Conrad was glad of that.
Well, Conrad, I hope this doesn't backfire on you. I know you're anxious to solve the problems plaguing your railroad, but having a man like Frank Morgan working for you may present you with even more problems.
I have every confidence in him, sir. He's never let me down.
And with a shock, Conrad realized that was true. Both times he had been kidnapped, Frank had rescued him.
I hope you're right. Pamela and I are on our way back to the hotel. Would you like to join us for late supper?
I'm hardly presentable.
That's not a problem. We'll give you time to clean up. You can meet us in the hotel dining room in, say, an hour?
That's fine. Thank you, sir.
Not at all. I'm looking forward to spending more time with you. I know Pamela is, too.
Of course I am. Mwah. We'll see you later, darling.
They strolled out of the store, leaving Conrad there. He had been hoping that he wouldn't run into Pamela and her father right away. He liked to plan out such things in advance. That hadn't happened tonight, and he had been forced to improvise. But he hadn't done too badly, he told himself. The whole thing with Rebel was embarrassing, of course, but Pamela seemed to be willing to forget about it. The problem, he suddenly realized, was that he didn't know if he could forget about Rebel. Rebel made arrangements with the elderly owner of the livery stable to care for the horses. She told the man that she preferred to put them away for the night. She had always liked doing that when she had problems to think out. She found that sometimes horses were easier to talk things over with than people.
Inferno, let me ask you something. How could I ever become interested in some damn eastern dude who acts most of the time like he's got a corn cob shoved up his butt? If he wasn't such a handsome man, and if he hadn't jumped on top of me to shield me with his own body like he had during that fight with the Apaches, I know what you're thinking. He is rich. Well, that doesn't mean anything to me. The fact that he's intelligent, and he obviously has at least some courage, those things are more important. After getting to know Conrad and Frank, I think Cousin Ed and my brothers are in the wrong in this vendetta they have against Morgan. He's a good man, and he never would have killed my other cousins if they hadn't forced him into it. Best thing for the Callahan boys to do would be to forget about Frank Morgan. But they won't. Oh, no, Inferno. I am not worried about snooty Miss Tarleton. If I want to, I can take Conrad away from some pale, skinny little simp from Philadelphia. Well, I have to go over to that swanky hotel and take Mr. Browning his Winchester rifle. Why, you ask? Because Mr. High and Mighty Executive left it with his horse. Inferno, you are a fine listener. You have yourself a nice night.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like a room.
Just for yourself?
I ain't got a husband, and I ain't expecting any gentleman callers, so yeah, just for me.
Of course. If you'll just sign in.
Rebel lay the Winchesters on the desk.
The rate is $1 a night.
You got a mighty high opinion of your rooms, don't you?
I don't set the prices, ma'am. Ophir is a boom town, after all. Everything costs more here.
I reckon if you charge that much, the hotel ought to provide a hot bath, too?
Actually, we do have a bathhouse just out the back. And I believe there's a fresh tub of hot water that's been recently drawn. There should be an attendant back there to help you. Your key.
Much obliged. Reckon I'll clean up first, then go upstairs.
As you wish, ma'am.
I wish you'd stop calling me ma'am. Never did like the sound of it.
Without any more conversation, she picked up the rifles and headed down a hallway toward the rear door of the hotel, looking for that bathhouse. She found the windowless building just outside the hotel's back door. There were two zinc-plated tubs with a canvas partition between them. Canvas curtains could be pulled across in front of each tub to give the bathers some privacy.
The señorita wishes to bathe?
Darn right I do.
That water is freshly drawn and still hot.
Sounds mighty fine.
As Rebel approached the tub, she saw little wisps of steam rising from the surface of the clean water. The sight made her realize just how badly she wanted to sink down into it and soak away some of the aches and pains of the past week, not to mention all the trail dust. She pulled the curtain, placed the rifles and her saddlebags next to the tub on a chair that had a towel draped over its back.
This looks perfect.
Within minutes, she was nude. She lifted a leg and poised it over the water, then lowered it slowly, adjusting to the heat. She stepped in with her other leg and sank slowly into the tub.
I am just going to sit here and soak. And not even think about Conrad Browning. Whatever he's doing, he's on his own.
Conrad was about to leave the Emporium when the two men Sam Brandt had sent with him and Rebel came in to give the order for supplies to the proprietor. Since he was already there, Conrad waited until the transaction was complete, satisfying himself that the men had carried out Brandt's orders as they should. Following that brief delay, he walked over to the Holloway house. The clerk greeted him with a smile, remembering him from previous visits.
No need for you to sign in, Mr. Browning. I'll take care of that for you. You want your usual room?
Yes, please, George, if it's available.
Yes, sir, here you go. Got any bags you need help with?
No, not this time. I've left my saddlebags at the livery. I'll be right back.
Of course, sir.
It took only a few minutes to walk over to the livery stable and reclaim his saddlebags from the elderly owner. The clerk wasn't behind the desk when Conrad came back into the hotel. He started to go upstairs, but then changed his mind. He knew from experience that there was a bathhouse right behind the hotel. The bathhouse door was open. He stepped inside and saw that the Mexican woman who usually worked there was gone. Were all the hotel employees shirking their duty at the moment? The curtain on the right was pulled, meaning that someone was using that tub. Conrad went into the compartment on the left and reached down to test the temperature of the water. It was only warm, not hot, and looked as if it had been used by a previous bather. That wasn't too bad for a frontier town. He set his saddlebags aside and began to get undressed. As he did, he heard a faint splash from the other tub as whoever was in it moved around. When he was naked, Conrad put one foot in the tub, still wishing the water was warmer. He lifted his other leg and lowered that foot into the water. As he did so, he heard more splashing from the other side of the canvas partition. It sounded like the other bather was standing up to get out of the tub. That was when Conrad's foot came down on the bar of soap left in the tub by whoever had used it before. The soap had sunk to the bottom, and he never saw it. He certainly felt it, though, when it squirted out from under him and threw him completely off balance. What he got hold of was the canvas partition. It slowed his fall so that he merely splashed down in the tub without injuring himself, although a lot of the water sloshed over the sides. But the canvas tore all along the top where it was nailed to the ceiling, and it fell too, so there was no longer any barrier between the two tubs.
Oh, Lord.
Conrad sprawled there in the water, half-stunned, staring at the nude body of Rebel Callahan as she stood upright in the other tub, the towel she had just picked up from the chair next to it clutched in her hands, but not yet concealing any of her bare loveliness. All the mental images that Conrad's fevered brain had conjured up when Rebel talked about swimming nude in the pond flashed into his mind so that he could compare them with the reality. Rebel was a vision, her smooth pink skin glowing and glistening damply, the curves of her body sweeping in and out in a sensuous rhythm as pleasing to the eye as the notes of a brilliant concerto were to the ear. Conrad was so overwhelmed that he couldn't do anything except lie there and stare at her, enthralled by her beauty. Instead of trying to cover herself, she dropped the towel, surprising him even more. Then she snatched up one of the rifles lying next to the tub.
You son of a bitch!
Conrad realized his danger at the last second and gulped down a breath of air just before he ducked under the surface of the water that remained in the tub. The rifle blasted, the sound deafening in these close quarters, even though his ears were underwater and the report was somewhat muffled. Knowing that the outraged young woman would have to work the rifle's lever again before she could fire a second shot, he stuck his head up.
Rebel, no, don't!
Then he was diving for cover again as another shot roared. As he huddled there, holding his breath, wondering if he was going to die in this tub, the thought occurred to him that the only way this situation could get worse would be if Pamela Tarleton chanced to step into the bathhouse at this very moment. Perhaps it would be better if Rebel just went ahead and shot him before that could happen.
Dios mío!
The Mexican woman hurried into the bathhouse and saw the naked blonde woman standing in one tub and pointing a rifle at the other tub.
Señorita, no, do not kill him.
If I wanted to kill him, he'd already be dead. I just want him to think twice before he pokes his head up out of that tub again like a damn turtle.
Rebel set the rifle aside and picked up her towel again, wrapping it around herself as she stepped out of the tub. Wide-eyed, Conrad looked around frantically, evidently intending to duck for cover again if he needed to.
Take it easy. I'm not going to plug you. Even though I ought to, you damn sneak.
You can't believe that I did that on purpose. It was an accident.
Sure it was. Just like you accidentally forgot to tell me you had a fiancé waiting for you when we got here.
I wasn't certain she would be here.
Mm-hmm. But... Save your breath, comrade. I'm not interested anymore.
Señorita, you will not shoot that man.
No. I'm not gonna have anything more to do with that man.
Rebel,
I don't know how you got in here, comrade, or what you hoped to accomplish, but the least you can do is be a gentleman and turn around while I get dressed.
Yes, of course, Rebel. I really am so sorry.
I don't want to hear it. Lady, guard that door.
Si, señorita.
With the attendant's formidable figure standing there to keep anyone from coming in, Rebel finished pulling on some clean clothes from her saddlebags. Footsteps sounded outside, and the doorknob rattled as someone grasped it. The Mexican woman held it on the inside so that it wouldn't turn.
No entrada!
What's going on in there? We heard gunshots!
Everything is all right. An accident only. Nothing to worry about.
Are you sure? No one's forcing you to say that.
This is Mr. Browning, Bennett. Everything is fine, I assure you.
He sounded more calm and collected than he looked, huddled there in a tub, now less than half full of water, trying to keep the more important parts of his anatomy under the surface. If Rebel hadn't been so mad at him, she would have had to laugh. He looked so ludicrous.
I'll leave your Winchester here.
Thank you. Can I turn around now?
You could, but I'd rather you didn't. I might see something I don't want to see.
Rebel, this is very embarrassing.
You deserve to be embarrassed. Sneaking in here that way and pulling down the partition just to get a look at me and the all together?
She put her hat on without bothering to tuck her hair up into it. With the Winchester under her arm, she went to the door and nodded to the attendant. The Mexican woman let go of the knob and stepped back. With all the dignity she could muster, Rebel opened the door and stepped out. Right offhand, Conrad couldn't remember a time when he had felt more humiliated. He was sure there had been occasions that were more embarrassing, but he couldn't recall them. The only thing he had to be thankful for was that Pamela didn't know about the incident. Yet.
I'm in no mood to finish my bath. Would you mind stepping outside so I can get dressed?
Si, señor.
Thank you. And would you send Bennett in, please?
Si, señor.
What can I do for you, Mr. Browning?
I need you to do me a favor, Bennett.
Of course, Mr. Browning.
Miss Tarleton and her father are waiting for me in the dining room. Could you go in there and tell them that I'm not feeling well and that I've retired for the evening?
Certainly. Is there any other message you'd like me to give them?
Just convey my apologies.
What he needed, he told himself suddenly, was a drink. But not in the hotel bar. That would be just asking to be made fun of. Ophir had plenty of saloons, though, and he was willing to bet that he could slip into one of them, keep his head down, and not call attention to himself, and not be recognized while he had a drink, or two. Especially since he was still wearing his dusty clothes. He hadn't thought to put on clean ones after hurriedly drying off after the bathhouse ruckus. The Big Nugget Saloon was perfect for what Conrad required. It was one of the largest drinking establishments in Ophir, and there was always a good crowd on hand. The more people there were around, the easier it would be for him to blend in unrecognized, he reasoned. To the left were tables crowded with men who were drinking and gambling. Saloon girls in short, spangled dresses circulated among the tables, delivering drinks and laughing as the customers pawed them. Four more girls wearing even scantier outfits danced on a small raised stage at the rear of the room while a slick-haired professor pounded on a piano. All in all, it was crude, loud, and squalid. It was also exactly what Conrad wanted at the moment.
Barkeep, a beer, please.
A heavy-set bartender brought it to him and expertly scooped up the coin Conrad dropped on the hardwood.
Finally. Solitude.
He wasn't by himself for long, though. One of the saloon girls appeared beside the table, almost as if by magic.
Hello, honey. You don't want to drink alone, do you?
Yes, that's exactly what I want to do.
The girl sat down beside him anyway, without being invited. She was tall and rather slender, with straight red hair. Her blue dress was scandalously short and cut low enough in the front so that he could see fully half of her breasts. Compared to either Rebel or Pamela, she was undeniably plain. And Conrad wasn't attracted to her at all. As she edged her chair nearer and leaned toward him so that her breasts were even more visible, he felt only a vague revulsion at the very idea of taking her to bed, which was probably what she wanted.
Buy me a drink, Sugar Plum?
Of course. In fact,
He took a coin from his pocket and slid it toward her on the table.
I'll pay you to go drink with someone else.
You don't want me to drink with you?
That's right. It's nothing against you, miss. I just don't desire any company at the moment except this fine product of the brewer's art.
Lousy, you talk funny. You ain't from around these parts, are you?
No. I come from a place far, far away.
Albuquerque? No, let me guess. Santa Fe?
Farther than that.
Denver.
Listen, miss, I...
Honey, you run along now and bother some other cowboy.
I wasn't bothering him none, was I, mister?
No, you were fine, but I'd just as soon be alone.
You heard the man.
The stranger was well-dressed in a brown tweed suit and had sleek dark hair. Something about him was vaguely familiar, but Conrad couldn't place him. Still pouting, the girl got up and left the table. The stranger took her place in a chair.
Perhaps you didn't hear me. I'd prefer to be alone right now.
Oh, I heard you, but I reckon you'd better listen to me. My name's Jonas Wade. I saw you back in El Paso with Frank Morgan as I was leaving the hotel where Morgan saved my life.
He swept a well-manicured hand at their surroundings.
I own this place now, thanks to three queens and a pair of jacks that showed up in my hand at just the right time.
You won it in a poker game?
That's right. Luckiest day of my life, I guess. Hey, except for the day I met Frank Morgan.
I remember you now. We weren't introduced, but I saw you with Frank. My name is Conrad Browning.
The mine owner? The fellow who's building a spur line up here from Lordsburg?
That's the one.
I've heard of you, and I'm mighty pleased to meet you, Mr. Browning. Is Frank with you?
Not at the moment, no. He's still down at the railroad construction camp.
That's good. If he was here in town, I wanted to warn him.
Warn him about what?
There are three men in town. I think they're relatives of that hombre Frank had to kill back in El Paso. And they say that as soon as they see the Drifter again, they're going to kill him.
The mood in the camp was still somber the next morning after the explosion that had destroyed the trestle. No one would soon forget the guard who had been killed or the destruction that had been caused. After breakfast, Frank and Sam Brandt stood outside the railroad car where the construction boss and his foreman had their office and living quarters.
What are your plans for today, Sam?
Well, we'll get started rebuilding the trestle, I suppose. There's really nothing else we can do. The line can't go anywhere until it gets across this gorge.
I don't know much about building a railroad, but hasn't the roadbed already been graded between here and Ophir?
Yeah, you can follow it all the way on to the settlement without any trouble. You thinking of leaving?
Not at all. The reason I asked was because I was wondering if you could somehow get rails and cross ties across to the other side and have some of the men laying them while the rest of the crew was working on the trestle.
Well, I guess you could load ties on a cart and trundle it down the trail on this side of the gorge, across the pontoon bridge, and then up on the trail on the other side. Only way to get rails across, though, would be to have a gang of men carry them one at a time the same way. It'd be slow as hell.
But you'd be making at least a little progress that way. Or do you need the whole crew working on the trestle?
No, I've really got more men than I need for that. You see, normally what you do is you send a crew on ahead of you to build the trestles and have them ready when the rails reach them. That way it doesn't take long to lay the rails across the trestle, and then you just go right on once you're on the other side. The men working on this one ran into problems, though, and it's a damn big project. We caught up to them before they finished, and now we're stuck here.
Unless you put as many men on the trestle as are practical to work on it, and have the others carry ties and rails across and start putting down track. Even if they only get a mile done in the time it takes to rebuild and finish the trestle, that's that much you won't have to build once you're across. You could consider it a running start.
Well, it might work. Only a fellow who never built a railroad would come up with an idea like that, though.
Sometimes a fresh pair of eyes comes in handy. Helps you see things differently.
I'll talk to the boys about it and see what they think. In the meantime, what do you figure on being up to today?
I'm still convinced that the gang causing you so much trouble is holed up somewhere around here. I'm gonna keep looking for them.
Well, good luck to you. If you find them, though, don't try to tackle them alone. Come on back here and tell me. I've got plenty of men just itching for a crack at those bastards.
Frank nodded. but he was thinking that the railroaders might not be much of a match for the gang. Based on the two encounters so far, he suspected the troublemakers were hired guns, at least for the most part. They would be experienced killers, and pitting even tough railroaders against them might not be enough. A short time later, he rode out of camp with Wolf padding along beside him. The day before, although he had ridden all around the camp, he had concentrated his search in the area north of the railhead across the river. Today, he decided to turn his efforts more to the south. It was possible the gang was trailing the railroad rather than staying out ahead of it. Frank followed the rails back toward the pass, where he and Conrad and Rebel had run into the man who had blown up the dynamite shed. Before he reached the pass, he veered off onto a likely-looking trail that led up higher into the mountains. This was a game trail, Frank decided, as it switched back and forth and climbed steadily. At one point, he was able to rein in, twist around in the saddle, and look back down the mountain toward the river gorge. He saw the construction camp at least a mile away and hundreds of feet below him. He faced forward again and was about to hitch Stormy into motion when a flash from the slopes above him suddenly caught his eye. The reflection was only there for a second, but Frank knew he hadn't imagined it. He stiffened in the saddle.
Somebody's up there, Wolf. That reflection might have been off a gun barrel, or more likely a pair of field glasses. Out here in the middle of nowhere, there's only one thing for somebody to be keeping an eye on. The construction camp. Stay close, Wolf.
Frank began to ride higher along the trail. After a few minutes, he reined Stormy to a halt again and swung down from the saddle. Sound carried well in this thin air, and if he rode any closer, he chanced that the watcher would hear the clink of the Appaloosa's shoes against the rocky ground. Frank estimated that the flash he had seen was now about 500 yards above him on the side of the mountain. He would have to go the rest of the way on foot. In some places, the climb was fairly easy. In others, he had to lean forward and hang onto the slope with both hands as he slowly made his way upward. He stopped often and checked to see where he was in relation to the spot where he had seen the reflection. He was circling it gradually, getting above that point. When Frank reached an area he thought would put him in the right position, he crawled forward on hands and knees, up a slanted rock that overlooked a broad ledge about 10 feet below it. When Frank came to the edge of the rock, he saw that the ledge was littered with boulders. And sure enough, a man was crouched among those boulders. He had a rifle, a canteen, and a canvas pouch. A pair of field glasses hung around his neck on a strap. As Frank looked on, the man leaned forward, lifted the glasses to his eyes, and trained them on the railroad construction camp, which was visible far below. Frank pondered his next move. He could jump this hombre here and now and try to get some information from him, or he could try to follow the man and hope that he would lead him back to the rest of the gang causing trouble for the New Mexico, Rio Grande, and Oriental. Frank hadn't decided on a course of action when the problem was solved for him. The rock on which he lay suddenly shifted. It hadn't been as firmly lodged in the side of the mountain as he'd thought. The rock didn't go very far, only a couple of inches, but that was enough to cause a noise and make the watcher spring to his feet and twist around to peer upward in surprise. When he saw Frank, he started to reach down and grab for his rifle. Frank launched himself into the air. The man had his rifle in his hands, but he hadn't had time to lift it and turn when Frank crashed into him in a clean tackle, causing him to drop the rifle.
Don't try anything funny, partner. I don't want to kill you, but I'll put a bullet through your knee if I have to.
Don't shoot, mister.
Who are you?
Who are you?
I just asked you the same question. You first.
My name is Walt Shear.
Why are you keeping an eye on that railroad camp, Shear? Planning to cause some more trouble for those men down there?
What? I haven't caused any trouble for them.
No? You didn't have anything to do with that trestle blowing up last night?
Is that what happened? I could tell it had been a fire, but I wasn't sure about an explosion.
Quit trying to pull the wool over my eyes. Are you trying to tell me you don't work for the gang that's been causing so much trouble?
I work for the Southwestern and Pacific Railroad. I'm a construction engineer.
That answer took Frank by surprise. He was expecting Shear to lie, of course, but he hadn't expected the sort of claim the man had just made.
What have you got to do with that spur line going from Lordsburg to Ophir?
Nothing, yet. But when the NMRG&O fails to finish the line, The SWP plans to step in and take over the job. I'm up here studying the route so that we can do it better.
That doesn't sound too likely to me. You were watching the camp.
You can see the camp from here, sure, but take another look. There's also a good view of the gorge, and you can see for at least 3 miles on the other side of it.
The young man seemed truly excited by this as he warmed to his subject, turning and pointing.
There's the roadbed that's been graded, but look over yonder.
Shear pointed in a different direction, hardly able to contain his glee.
The trestle's in the right spot, but if you curve the line to the west a little once you reach the top of that slope, your roadbed will go over more level terrain. There's already a natural cut through that ridge, too, so you could use that instead of having to blast out one of your own.
All right, son, let me take a look. But please, don't try anything. I'm trying really hard not to kill anyone today.
Don't worry, I won't.
After studying the landscape on the far side of the gorge for a few moments, Frank had to admit that Shear might be right about the alternate route he suggested being easier.
Nathan Buckhalter was in charge of the survey that laid out the route.
Nathan Buckhalter's a poor excuse for a surveyor and engineer. He wouldn't know the best way for the line to go if it came up and bit him.
Professional jealousy?
There's nothing to be jealous of. I'm twice as good at my job as he is at his.
That display of puffed-up pride did as much as anything to convince Frank that Walt Shear was telling the truth. The man was what he seemed to be. He was spying on Conrad's railroad, not because he wanted to sabotage it, but because the company he worked for wanted the job of building the spur line for itself. Of course, before they could do that, the New Mexico, Rio Grande, and Oriental would have to fail.
How do you know the railroad's not going to reach Ophir? Even if you're telling me the truth, Shear, how do I know that other hombres working for your bosses aren't trying to stop that railroad?
I wouldn't know anything about that. I was just sent up here to study the route and figure out if there were ways we could improve upon it. There are, and that's what I intend to report to my bosses, unless you're planning on killing me.
Not unless you give me more cause than you have so far.
As for how I know the NMRG&O is going to fail, I don't. But with men like Nathan Buckhalter working for it, I don't see how the line's ever going to succeed.
Frank wasn't convinced that Buckhalter was as bad at his job as Shear made him out to be. At the moment, though, that wasn't really important.
Somebody has been causing trouble for the line and trying to make sure it never gets through to Ophir. You got any ideas about that?
Not really. Unless those men who are camped over that way about a mile have something to do with it.
He pointed to the east over a series of rugged ridges.
There's a camp over there?
It was yesterday when I saw it. I couldn't say if the men are still there or not.
You can find the place again?
Of course. I'm an expert at terrain and topography. I don't get lost.
Grab your hat and prove it.
What do you mean by that?
You're going to show me where this camp is.
Why should I do that? And by the way, you never told me who you are.
My name is Frank Morgan. Some folks call me the Drifter.
I've heard that name. You're some sort of gunfighter.
When I have to be. Right now, though, I'm the fella you're gonna take to that camp you saw yesterday. And you better hope that you've been telling me the truth.
As Frank had suspected, there was a trail leading down from the other end of the ledge. That was how Shear had gotten up here. The trail led down to a little canyon with a tiny creek running through it. A few trees and some sparse grass lined the stream. Shear's horse was picketed there, cropping at the grass. Shear led the animal while he and Frank walked, as they made their way back to the spot where Frank had left Stormy and Wolf.
Easy, Wolf.
Is that a wolf?
Not full-blooded. He might have a little wolf in him, though. Not all that sure about his ancestry.
He looks like he wants to tear my throat out.
He won't, though. Not unless you do something he thinks is a threat to me.
What if he's wrong?
That would be a shame. I'm putting your rifle back in the saddle boot. Keep your hands away from it unless we're attacked.
I understand. Mr. Morgan? Are we gonna be attacked?
There's always that chance, young man.
Oh...
All right, take me to that other camp you were talking about.
Shear led the way. They rode through canyons and along ridges and past towering spires of rock. Sometimes they passed through narrow defiles where they had to ride one behind the other, and the sky was nothing but a narrow blue band between dizzyingly high walls of stone. Finally, they came to the top of a slope that was thickly covered with pine and juniper trees.
Down there, there's a little valley. And that's where the camp is.
It might have been weeks before I found this spot. Mr. Shear, you have come in quite handy.
Glad to be of help.
Frank couldn't see anything because of the trees, but as he leaned forward in the saddle and sniffed, he smelled wood smoke in the air. Just a faint tang, but it was there, an unmistakable indication that there was a campfire somewhere close by.
Get off your horse.
What are you gonna do?
Go down there and take a look around. You're coming with me.
Listen, I'm not a gunfighter. I'm not any kind of fighter. I'm just an engineer. I draw plans. I can barely shoot a rifle.
I don't plan on doing any fighting. I just want to get a good look at the place and see what I'm up against.
I probably ought to stay here and hold the horses.
Even though Frank had just about decided that Cheer was telling the truth, he didn't want the man at his back while he was trying to sneak up on the place where the saboteurs were camped.
We'll tie the horses so they can't wander off. You're coming with me. Here, take your rifle. You shouldn't need it, but just in case you do.
You're gonna get me killed.
I'll do my best not to.
If Shear was putting on an act, he was damned good at it. They started moving down the slope through the trees. Frank gave Shear whispered instructions on where and how to place his feet so that their progress would be as quiet as possible. Shear nodded, and his nerves seemed to relax a little. The prospect of sneaking up on the camp had scared him, but now that he was actually doing something, he wasn't quite as nervous.
Shh. Listen.
What?
Voices.
Carefully, Frank parted the brush and peered through the little gap he had made in the branches.
There they are.
Frank and Shear were almost at the bottom of the slope. The ground leveled out into a small grassy park. On the other side of that clearing, about a quarter of a mile away, a cliff rose some 200 feet into the air. The rock face bulged out, creating a cave-like space at the base of it. That was where the men were camped. They were also protected from the rain there, and that was going to come in handy because the clouds Frank had seen earlier in the day had finally concentrated enough to form a mountain shower.
What do we do now?
We get to the construction camp as fast as we can and pick up some reinforcements there. And we'll come back and have it out with those saboteurs.
How do you know they're to blame for what's been happening to the railroad?
I don't, not for sure. But if they have a reasonable explanation for being camped out here like this, they'll have to convince those railroaders.
I don't like this. Things could get out of hand, especially if those men are innocent.
I don't much cotton to it either. But I'll see to it that the railroad men don't turn into a lynch mob.
They started backtracking up the slope. The sky grew darker, and the wind picked up, and the rain was starting to come more quickly now. They were almost at the top when Frank suddenly heard voices over the soughing of the wind in the trees. A second later, Stormy gave an angry nicker, and Wolf began to growl. Somebody was up there where Frank and Shear had left the horses.
Careful, Royal! That varmint looks like a wolf. He's liable to come after you.
Well, if he moves, shoot him.
Frank's heart took an angry leap in his chest as he heard Wolf being threatened. He abandoned stealth and burst through the undergrowth with a crackling of brush. Behind him, Shear did his best to keep up.
Oh, Lord, help me, please!
The peacemaker was already in Frank's hand as he emerged from the trees and brush into the open. His keen, experienced eyes took in the scene in an instant. Four armed men stood there, while a fifth hung back about 100 yards, holding their horses. The men had spotted Stormy, Wolf, and Shear's horse, and had snuck up here to see who the animals belonged to.
Who the hell is this?
It's Morgan! Got him!
Shear, get back!
Frank triggered a return shot that smashed the shoulder of one of the men.
Get behind a tree for cover!
But Shear, backing up hastily, tripped over a rock and fell backward with a startled yell. The rifle flew out of his hands as he toppled down the slope. Frank knew he couldn't expect any help from Shear in this fight. Wolf launched himself in an attack as well. The big cur slammed into one of the gunmen and took him down, tearing at the screaming man with his teeth. Frank's last shot wounded one of the men. That left only one of the four hard cases who wasn't either wounded or under attack by Wolf. That man emptied his Colt in Frank's direction, forcing the drifter to throw himself to the ground and roll behind a tree for cover. The last couple of bullets slammed into the trunk above his head. Before Frank could bring his Colt to bear, the gunman yanked a second revolver from a cross-draw holster on his left hip and bounded forward. Bashir's out-of-control tumble had come to an end when the engineer crashed into a tree trunk. The gunman dropped into a crouch beside the stunned Shear and jammed the barrel of his pistol against Shear's head.
Morgan! Give it up, or I'll blow his brains out!
Lying about 20 feet away along the slope, Frank had no trouble seeing that the man's thumb looped over the hammer of the gun was all that was holding it back. Even if Frank shot him and killed him instantly, his thumb would slip off the hammer and the gun would go off, putting a bullet through Shear's skull.
Take it easy. I'm coming out.
Come with them meat hooks held high or I'll kill him.
Frank climbed to his feet and came forward slowly, his hands lifted slightly above his head. The Colt was still in his right hand, but he had flipped it around so that he held it by the cylinder.
All right. Put that smoke pole on the ground. Step away from it.
After placing the peacemaker on the ground, Frank moved away from it. Lightning flashed and thunder boomed. The rain began to fall a little harder.
Call off your dog, damn it!
Wolf, come here!
The hard case, who seemed to be the boss of the bunch, straightened to his feet and pulled Shear upright with him. The engineer had recovered somewhat from crashing into the tree, but now he was pale and terrified from being threatened with the gun. The man kept the pistol barrel pressed against Shear's skull as he jerked his head toward the top of the slope.
Get moving! Pray to get over here!
The man who had been holding the horses hurried forward.
Get Morgan's gun and the rifle this bastard dropped, and then tend to slow back and dent him.
Oh.
The man pushed Shear toward Frank, and then stepped back to cover both of them as the engineer stumbled forward. Frank caught hold of Shear's arm to steady him. The man called Brady went first to one of the hombres Frank had shot and tore strips of cloth off the wounded man's shirt to use as bandages. He tied them tightly around the bullet-shattered shoulder, ignoring the shrieks of pain that his rough ministrations brought.
Gotta get the bleeding stopped.
Then he moved over to the other injured man and began binding up those wounds as best he could.
Slovak's okay, but I don't know if Dennehy's gonna make it, Royal. Damn dog like to gnaw his arm right off.
You do what you can for him. Thad, you all right?
Yeah, just wing me. I'll be okay.
Well, don't let them horses wander off while Brady's busy.
Sure thing, Roy.
While you're at it, get the Winchester off Morgan's saddle.
I ain't sure about getting that close to that big spotted horse, Royal. He don't like me.
Somebody's got to do it, blast it! Now do what I told you! Morgan, you keep that horse calm down or I'll kill some bitch.
Easy, Stormy. Easy, boy. You can get the rifle now. Just don't make any sudden moves while you're doing it.
Yeah.
Thad came up and slid the rifle out of the saddle boot. The young gunman backed off in a hurry once he had the Winchester.
Mister, can I get my hat?
Go ahead. Brady, you about finished with Dennehy?
I've done all I can for him. Once we get back to camp, maybe I can patch him up a little better.
All right. You and Thad get him on his horse. Slovak, stop your whimpering. Get up and get mounted.
I don't know if I can, Royal. My shoulder really hurts.
I got a cure for it. It's called a bullet through the head. Your shoulder won't hurt a damn bit after that.
Royal waggled the barrel of his gun at Frank and Shear.
Mount up, you two! Morgan, you go right ahead and try something if you're of a mind to. It'd give me great pleasure to ventilate you.
You're the boss right now, Royal.
Meaning it ain't always gonna be that way. I don't think so, Morgan. Now that we got our hands on you, we ain't let go. I'm tempted to just go ahead and kill you right here now, but I'm gonna hold off for a while and take it over. Might be some way we can make even better use of you.
Frank wasn't sure what Royal meant by that. He would never cooperate with the gang, that was for sure. But the important thing was that he and Shear hadn't been executed out of hand, and as long as they were still alive, there was a chance they could do something to turn the tables on their captors. Frank was going to hold on to that hope for as long as possible.
All right, let's go!
The group moved out, riding along the top of the slope until they came to a trail that led down to the little valley where the camp was located. They turned and rode downhill, and the rain slashed at them, hard and cold and merciless. Frank was soaked to the skin by the time he and Walt Shear reached the cave-like area underneath the overhanging cliff. So were the other members of the group, and they were in a mighty foul mood the wetter they got. The men who were already in camp must have built up the fire when the wind grew colder, because it was burning brighter now and giving off welcome heat. Several of them picked up rifles when they noticed that the newcomers had a couple of prisoners with them.
Royal, we heard shots up on the ridge. Who the hell's that you got with you?
This one's Frank Morgan. I don't know who the other bastard is.
Morgan? The drifter his own self, you mean?
That's right.
Well, I'll be.
All right, Morgan, you and your buddy plant yourself on that rock over there while I try to figure out what I'm gonna do with you. Oh, Brady, you and Thad see to Denny. Make him as comfortable as you can.
Oh.
Oh, good God. Somebody help Slovak before he starts to cry.
Come on, Slovak.
In the light from the fire, Frank glanced up at the rock wall looming above his head. He was in an almost perfect natural dwelling, protected from the wind and rain on three sides by rock and above by the overhanging boulder. Still holding a gun, Royal came over and glared at Frank and Shear. He was a burly man with slightly stooped shoulders and a rugged face dominated by a big nose that had been broken at least once.
Now just who in the hell are you, mister? You working with Morgan?
My name's Walt Shear. I work for the Southwestern and Pacific Railroad. I'm a surveyor and construction engineer. I never saw this man before today. I don't know who he is or what he's doing up here.
Is that so? It looked to me like two of you were pards when you came running out of those trees.
He forced me to go with him. Think about it. I never shot at you or put up any kind of fight.
No, you didn't put up a fight, that's for damn sure. He's too busy falling down that hill.
Leave him alone. He's telling you the truth. He doesn't know anything about what's going on. I ran into him earlier today and made him come with me because I thought he might be part of your bunch. Now I know he's not.
I don't give a damn about that. He knows where our camp is, so he's a threat to us.
No, I'm not. I swear I'm not. Let me go and I won't tell anybody where you are or what you're doing.
What are we doing?
You're trying to wreck the spur line that the New Mexico Rio Grande and Oriental Railroad is building and keep it from getting to Ophir, right?
Yeah, that's right. And since you know about that...
The gun in his hand came up.
Wait a minute. I'm not going to say anything. I don't care what you're doing. I don't want the spur line to go through either. Once it fails, the company I work for will come in and take over. We're on the same side!
Frank suddenly lunged toward Shear, driving him out of the way of the bullet Royal had aimed at his head. Shear cowered on the ground as Frank knelt beside him and looked up at Royal. Fingers of lightning clawed at the sky and lit up the gunman's face with an electric glare.
Get out of the way, Morgan! We don't need this sniveling son of a bitch no more.
You might as well kill us both then, because I'll never cooperate with you.
No! I told you I'm keeping you alive. Might be able to use you against young Browning. After all, what boy wouldn't want to keep his old pappy safe?
Royal knew that Conrad was Frank's son. How the hell was that possible? Conrad certainly hadn't told anyone. It had been obvious that he wanted to keep their relationship as much of a secret as possible. But Royal and these other hired killers who were trying to wreck the spur line knew. Confusion reigned in Frank's head for a few seconds until he pushed it all aside.
Don't have to worry about Shear. He's no threat. You can see that for yourself.
Shear was still crying and had his arms over his head, even though he had to know that wouldn't protect him from a bullet. The gesture was just instinct. Pure self-preservation, even though it was futile.
All right. He lives, for now. If either of you tries anything, he'll die mighty quick-like.
Take it easy, Shear. Pull yourself together, man. You're all right now.
Royal motioned some of his men forward.
Put them over there against the cliff and tie them up. As long as they stay quiet, you don't have to gag them. In fact, if they start to raise a ruckus, just bend a gun barrel over their heads. Don't kill Morgan, though.
What are you gonna do?
I gotta think. Well, Lux dropped you in my lap, Morgan, and now I gotta figure out what to do with you.
By the time a few more minutes had passed, Frank and Shear were sitting with their backs pressed against the rock, their arms pulled behind their backs and tied there uncomfortably.
These ropes are uncomfortable as hell.
Be thankful they didn't tie our legs.
The day passed slowly, and it seemed even longer than it was due to their captivity, their uncomfortable position, and the pouring rain that continued to fall for hours. The time gave Frank a chance to study their captors, though. The men all wore range clothes and were heavily armed. Their coarse-featured, beard-stubbled faces were typical of drifting hard cases, the sort of gunmen for hire who would do anything as long as the money was good enough. Their leader, Royal, seemed to be more intelligent than the others, but it was an animal cunning mixed with ruthlessness.
Rain stopped.
Yeah, the sun will be going down soon.
Do you have a plan? What happens when the sun goes down?
Well, I suppose it gets dark.
Royal and several more of the men had been talking among themselves for a while, occasionally casting veiled glances toward Frank and Shear. Frank didn't like the looks of the discussion, but he couldn't hear what they were saying.
I don't see why they couldn't feed us.
Shh. Quiet.
Come on, you have to be hungry too.
Trying to hear what those men are plotting. If I can hear them, it might just keep us alive. But I can't hear them if you keep sitting here bitching about food.
Sorry.
As it began to grow dark, Royal and a couple of the men stood up and walked toward them. Shear fell silent, perhaps sensing that something bad was about to happen.
I'm glad you talked me out of killing this fella, Morgan. Turns out we got a use for him after all.
Anything. I'll help you any way I can.
Better not be so quick to volunteer.
Hell, it don't matter whether he volunteers or not. We're gonna do the same thing either way. Take him, boys.
Wait, what are you... Don't...
The two men picked him up by the shoulders and feet and started to carry him toward the fire.
You know how them Apaches have been giving trouble around here, Morgan? How a band of renegade bucks has been raising hell.
I've heard about it.
Well, what do you think a bunch of savages like that would do if they was to catch a lone white man out by himself? Well, I'll tell you what they do. They grab him and have themselves some fun with him, that's what.
Put me down! Let me go! Please!
Frank felt a cold ball of horror form in his guts as Royal went on.
You know how Apaches have fun, don't you, Morgan? Ain't nothing those red heathens like better than torturing a white man. Seems to me that if a bunch of Apaches got hold of old Walt over there, well, they might just take his hide off him one strip at a time. And just to make it more interesting, maybe the knives they'd use to take his hide off would be heated up in the fire beforehand, so they could cook him a little at the same time they was skinning him.
Are you telling me that the Indian raids on the railroad weren't really the work of the Apaches at all?
Now, wouldn't that be a neat trick? Fact of the matter is, there are some Apaches up here in these mountains, and they don't like us pale faces. But as to whether or not they really done everything they've been blamed for, well, that's a good question. But when the folks down at the railroad camp find Shear's body in the morning, all skinned and scorched, don't you reckon the Apaches will get the blame again?
That was exactly what would happen, Frank knew. By the time Royal and his henchmen got through torturing Shear, it would probably be impossible to identify him. But the railroaders would be able to tell he had been a white man, and when they saw what had been done to him, they would be certain the Apaches had done it. The gruesome discovery would damage morale in the camp that much more.
I can't believe you'd do such a thing.
Believe it! We're getting paid a heap to make it harder for those boys to finish that railroad. And I don't give a damn who gets hurt along the way.
Please! Please! Please!
Shut that son of a bitch up! Oh!
A gun rose and fell, the barrel thudding against Shear's skull. He slumped down limply as the blow fell, out cold now. That was probably the most merciful thing that could happen to him, Frank thought bleakly. He was tied up and outnumbered 20-1, and there was nothing he could do to stop the hired killers from carrying out their grisly scheme.
Get on with it!
Frank wanted to close his eyes or look away, but he forced himself not to. He had promised Shear that he would try to keep him safe, and he had failed in that promise. The man was going to die in a drawn-out, agonizing fashion. Frank hoped the pain wouldn't make Shear regain consciousness, but he was afraid that wouldn't be the case. One of the men hunkered by the fire, holding the tip of a razor-sharp bowie knife in the flames until it glowed red-hot. While he was doing that, several of the men ripped Shear's shirt open and then pulled it off him. They left his trousers on. It would take a while to get to that part of his body with their torture.
Hold him down, boys. Even out cold, he's liable to jump around a mite once he feels his hot blade peeling his skin off.
Several men grasped Shear by the shoulders and legs, clamping tight grips on him. The knife wielder leaned over him. Shear's body jerked wildly, even though he was still unconscious, when the blade came in contact with his skin.
Look at him jump!
The man with the knife made a long, shallow cut across Shear's chest. Frank's jaw clenched so tight he thought his teeth might start to shatter. Despite his reputation as a gunfighter, he had never been a bloodthirsty man, never believed in senseless violence. At this moment, however, he gladly would have put a bullet through the brain of every man gathered around the helpless engineer. And Frank would never have lost a second's sleep over the killings.
We'll just heat this up a little more, then cut down each side, and we'll start to peel the hide back. Just like one of them damned Apaches was doing it.
He was too impatient in his cruelty to wait for long, though. After only a few moments, he took the blade out of the fire and turned back toward Shear. Then he toppled forward, dropping the knife, and landed in a limp sprawl across Shear's bleeding body. It took everyone under the overhang of the cliff, including Frank, a second or two to realize that the thing sticking straight up from the fallen man's back was the shaft of an arrow.